From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program would not be possible without the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. Please know how very thankful we are for your support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Happy Independence Day, everybody. With the holiday weekend upon us, firing up the barbecue and presenting a patriotic red, white, and blue best of edition of State of Belief Radio.
I'm Ray Kirstein. Thank you so much for listening today. We are taking the Independence Day weekend off to celebrate the proud history of this nation, as well as to get ready for extensive special coverage of both the Republican and Democratic national conventions that we are planning to bring you later this month. Way back in 2008, State of Belief Radio observed the 4th of July with some unforgettable patriotic interviews that deserve to be heard again. And so, this week we'll rewind to that summer for those important conversations. You'll hear Steve Wallman, founder of BeliefNet.com and the New York Times best-selling author of the book Founding Faith, How Our Founding Fathers Forged a Radical New Approach to Religious Liberty, and the late Forrest Church, who passed away in 2009. He appeared on State of Belief to discuss the release of his book, So Help Me God, The Founding Fathers, and the First Great Battle Over Church and State, the previous year. But first, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist John Meacham, who spoke to Welton right after publishing his book, American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation.
John, thank you for joining us on State of Belief.
Thank you, Reverend, for having me.
You see in the thoughts of the founders of this nation the prescription for sustaining a diverse nation without sacrificing faith or freedom. Did you begin with this conviction, or did you come to that conviction as you worked on this material?
I came to the conviction, and I was hoping that I would find what I found. I wanted to do the road to the religion clauses of the First Amendment, and then I found a much richer story, I think, which was the whole battle over religious freedom, both in the states and in the federal workings, and emerged with what I called the American Gospel, which I believe that the great good news about the country is that faith shapes us without strangling us or controlling us.
After looking at the primary documents and the founders of the nation closely, what is the most important myth regarding the founders and the founding? And I'm really, I guess, looking for a myth which, if confronted by the truth, would benefit the nation.
That's a great question. I think the idea that we were founded as a Christian nation is the most persistent myth, because I think many people on the religious right believe that we were founded as a Christian nation, that we have fallen from those pure origins, and that the point of political action is to get back to that Edenic state. If we could recover the spirit and sense of the Christian founding of the country, then would our moral life be more coherent? Things would be well. It's an appealing myth, and like many myths, it's full of holes. Historically, there is quite the opposite of there being evidence for this being a Christian nation. There's evidence to the contrary. George Washington, in 1790, in his first 4 years president, wrote a letter to the Hebrew congregation at Newport, Rhode Island, saying that the government of the United States shall give to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance. And then, borrowing an image from Micah, he said, "Every man should sit under his vine and fig tree, and none shall make him afraid." We passed a treaty in 1797 with the Muslim nation of Tripoli, in which we said that the government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian religion. The only mention of religion in the Constitution is to ban test oaths so that your civil rights were not part of any religious profession of belief. Theologically, as you know, you can't have a Christian nation. Just using the Christian scriptures, Jesus said to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were of this world, then would my servants fight." And so I think that is the Christian nation myth is the most persistent. I think if we can talk to people who believe that on both historical and theological grounds and convince them that it's not the case, then I think to some extent this the volume could come down a bit.
You conclude in your book a stirring observation, I think, that preserving American freedom is the most demanding of tasks, requires unrelenting work and a resilient spirit. I'm interested in, if you're doing that work, what are the top two or three items on your agenda?
Religious liberty is often called our first liberties, the first liberty in the First Amendment. And it's not just about what you do on Sunday morning, or it's not about somebody frog marching you down to a certain church. It's about liberty of thought. It's about how you think. It's about democracy. It's about how we can live and work together without coercion. And so I think the first thing to do is to ensure religious liberty, ensure freedom of conscience, make sure that church and state stay separate, but to respect that religion and politics can't be separated. And so, you know, if you're watching Meet the Press, if you're watching C-SPAN, if you're listening and you're following a debate and a person says, well, we have to do X for a religious reason, don't go crazy. Don't pound the person. Don't think, oh, my God, that's some crazy Christer. It may be. That person may be all those things. But they have a right to make this case, and you have a right to make the opposite case on whatever grounds you want. And the point of America, the point of the Republican system, lowercase r, as laid out in Federalist 10, is that all of us will go into the arena, we will let the contending forces bump up against each other, and through a system of checks and balances, we'll reach some temporary solution to something that'll get us through one storm until the next storm comes. Democracy is a completely unfinished work.
John, could the First Amendment to the Constitution, which guarantees us religious freedom, be passed today?
Oh, that's a great question. I think so, because, and here's why. I think that enough religious people understand, at least I hope they do, or they would in the course of that debate, that Ronald Reagan was right. The moment you deregulate something, it grows. And the moment we disestablished churches in the United States, religion took off. The Second Great Awakening, the great fervor of American religious spirit happened once the government got out of the business of churches. The reason Jefferson was so big on this is he was upset that Quakers were stripped of the rights of custody of children if they didn't have their children baptized in the Episcopal Church. Madison heard the cries of Baptist missionaries and ministers being tortured in Orange County, Virginia. So this was real to them. This was something that wasn't an abstraction. They had seen it. I think that enough people, I would hope, enough clergy, enough religiously active people would see that the free exercise clause is hugely important, obviously, and something we have to cherish, but that the establishment clause is good for the church and good for the state. Roger Williams used to talk about how we had to keep the garden of the church safe from the wilderness of the world.
Do you have counsel regarding the wisdom of amending the Constitution now, whether we're talking about the Flag Protection Amendment or defining marriage?
I'm a big believer that the reason they made it so hard to do is that we should do it very rarely. And I particularly think so in terms of the Madisonian construct of the checks and balances we have. Now, you hear a lot on the right about unaccountable, unelected judges. Well, you didn't hear a whole lot about that until the Republicans had both control of the White House and the Congress, and they realized that they still weren't getting exactly what they wanted, so they had to find somebody to talk about, and the judiciary moved into that vacuum. But you can't – it's sort of like if you're a secularist and you want to only read the Constitution and say, well, it doesn't mention God, so we're a secular country. Or if you're a religious person, you can't only just read the Declaration of Independence and say, well, it talks about nature's God and the Creator. You have to read them both together. If you're going to buy into the whole experiment, which we should do because it's the most enduring such arrangement in human affairs, you have to buy it whole. So you have checks and balances. We have a judiciary to be a break on these things. And if something is so outrageous that enough people want to do it, then amend the Constitution.
John Meacham, you're a great educator and inspirer, author of American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. John Meacham, thank you for being with us on State of Belief.
Thanks for having me.
In honor of our nation's holiday, we're taking a look back at some of our favorite interviews about the Constitution, the Founding Fathers, and of course, religion. Earlier this year, I spoke with author Steve Wallman. Steve and I spoke in March about his recently published book, Founding Faith, Providence, Politics, and the Birth of Religious Freedom in America. Here is our conversation. Steve, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you begin your book by exploring this powerful political alliance between Enlightenment intellectuals like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, who favored a kind of strict separation of religion and government, and then Christian evangelical leaders like John Leland and Isaac Backus. How was it that evangelicals in the 18th century favored a strong establishment clause when so many of them today promote the very opposite?
Well, to me, this is one of the most interesting things that I learned in my research, and one of the most important parts of the book, is that we would not have religious freedom today if it wasn't for this alliance of Madison and Jefferson and the 18th century evangelicals. Now, you know, the most common explanation you hear is that the Baptists were persecuted then, and so they didn't want to give more power to the established church. And there clearly was truth to that. But it went beyond that. They had a biblical rationale for why they believed church and state ought to be separate. Render unto Caesar was just the beginning of it. They felt that it really was better for religion if church and state were separated, and that went much beyond the persecution issue.
As you know, Leland and Backus both were Baptists. That's the tradition out of which I came, and I still am a Baptist. They actually said they would like theologically to see a Christian nation, but it wouldn't be authentic unless people had the freedom to make decisions about that.
Exactly. They had tremendous confidence in their faith. You know, they felt that if there was a sort of free marketplace of religion, that Christianity would win, or that it would do very well. And as you said, faith that is coerced is not legitimate faith, and is not a faith that is appreciated by God.
Yeah. When you mention religious freedom, most people go immediately to Jefferson and Madison, but you point out that George Washington led the way on this issue too. Tell us just a bit about that.
Yeah, it was surprising because a lot of his impact actually came before he was president as the leader of the Continental Army. And we have to remember that, you know, back then, they would, up until the point of the Revolution, it was really a conglomeration of 13 different countries or colonies. They were very parochial, didn't interact that much with each other. So the Continental Army was really one of the first national institutions. And so, for instance, things would happen like a lot of his troops were burning effigies of the Pope on Guy Fawkes Day in Massachusetts. And I probably no one else thought much of this, but Washington thought, first of all, we're trying to neutralize Canada. We're trying to get it so that there's no northern flank from Britain, and the Catholics in Canada are going to be antagonized by this. Secondly, we're trying to attract France as an ally, a crucial point in the war, and they're a Catholic country, so this is just stupid for us to go around hating Catholics. So he kind of came to his tolerance in part through the exigencies of war, of feeling this was going to be a much smarter approach.
You answer several fallacies about religion and the founders and even take on some myths. I guess one of the most popular, Steve, is this claim that the United States was established as a Christian nation. Is that true?
Well, it certainly was not established as a Christian nation. It was settled as a Christian land in the early days. That is true, and that's where some of the confusion comes from, is that it is true. The people founded not only Massachusetts but Virginia and other colonies, were intending to create a Christian paradise, and very much with the state and the church working very closely together to do it. What that leaves out is that after about 150 years of experimentation with that approach, the founding fathers looked at the wreckage and said, these experiments didn't work very well. Let's try something different.
You say the religious right is wrong in claiming the United States as a Christian nation, but you also point out that the left has it wrong when they argue that the framers envisioned a strict separation of church and state throughout the land. Now, why is that?
Well, a couple of reasons. For one thing, the founders of that era, when you think about the First Amendment, it was a compromise document. And though James Madison wanted strict separation throughout the land, he lost on a lot of key issues going into the First Amendment. So the First Amendment specifically was creating separation of church and state in the national government, but very clearly telling the states that they could do whatever they wanted, including continuing to have established churches and state-run or subsidized churches. Now, over the course of the next 200 years, partially because of the 14th Amendment after the Civil War, the principle that started out on the federal level gradually worked its way into more of the nooks and crannies of American life, but that was not what the founders as a collective at that moment were doing.
Aren't you amazed, or maybe you're not, that in that period of time there were so many people who shared common goals but were willing to push the envelope toward freedom and pass some measures that I'm not sure could get passed today?
Well, I think, you know, the example that really struck me of that is what you were alluding to earlier with this alliance of the Enlightenment philosophes and the evangelicals. Madison and Jefferson were clearly of a different class and sensibility. You can even occasionally see it in their writings that they are, you know, personally uncomfortable with the worship style of the Baptists of that era. But it didn't matter. They just felt like this was that philosophically in the fight for freedom, they were such kindred spirits that it made sense to join together and work in this cause.
Steve, there are a lot of people now saying that the First Amendment is not under attack as much today because the religious right is fading away. Do you sense the religious right is fading away?
Well, I think the religious right is changing. There's no diminution in the number of people who are religious conservatives, but there is an interesting moment right now where the leadership of the religious right is changing and being challenged, and the agenda is being questioned of whether or not it ought to perhaps include things like poverty or creation care, not just abortion and gay rights issues. So there is movement there. It has changed the political situation. I would argue that in addition to religious conservatives reassessing the agenda, poverty agenda, things like that, that it's time to also look at the history again. Because I think that, you know, if they were to look at the history of the 18th century evangelicals and the important heroic role that they played in giving us religious freedom and separation of church and state, that we would discover there's actually a more common ground between the left and modern evangelicals than probably anyone thought.
Steve Wallman's the editor-in-chief of BeliefNet and author of the new book, Founding Faith, Providence Politics, and the Birth of Religious Freedom in America. Steve, it's always great to talk with you, and thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Thanks so much for having me.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land is made for you and me.
Our next guest not only understands how it started, he argues that it's never really changed. Reverend Forrest Church is a minister of All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Manhattan. He's the author of the new book, So Help Me God, The Founding Fathers and the First Great Battle Over Church and State. Forest Church also comes from a distinguished line of prominent politicians. His grandfather was a governor, and his father was Frank Church, a six-term Democratic senator from Idaho. Forest Church is simply one of my best friends from whom I always learn in conversations. I sat down with Forrest in New York to talk about the book and what it means for modern politics. Forrest, welcome to State of Belief.
I'm delighted to be with you. I'm always delighted to be with you.
I want to get right into this book because you've done us a great service in publishing this. You have said that the group that says America was founded as a Christian nation and the group that says we have an explicitly secular foundation are both half right.
They're both 100% half right.
That's now exactly explain right. That.
Well, the same division we have today existed right at the founding. There are two sources that combine to create the American experiment. One is it comes out of New England. It's the notion of a Christian commonwealth or a commonwealth of God with a strong moral foundation. And the other comes out of the Enlightenment, particularly Enlightenment France, the notion of sacred liberty. So divine order and sacred liberty came right up against one another on this question of church-state separation.
So much of this thought is embodied, or it seems to me, is embraced by the phrase which you use and others do so regularly, so help me God. Tell us about that phrase.
Well, that goes into and then comes out of inaugural lore with Washington. It's not certain that he actually said it. I believe he did. There was an argument going on at the time as to whether or not senators and congressmen would swear, so help me God. That was the first bill indicated they would. Finally, they just swore to uphold the Constitution. But the first inaugural was set up by the church party, by an Episcopalian, actually, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia. And there was a worship service identified with the inaugural. I expect that Washington said, so help me God. I know that Jefferson asked the Supreme Court Justice John Marshall explicitly whether or not he had to say anything else other than the congressional oath. Marshall said he did not. From that point on until late in the 19th century when inaugurations were modeled after the Washington model, there was no so help me God in the oath of office that the president swore.
And when we look at the different perspectives on religion and the presidency, that comes out for most people out of a concern for the relationship between religious institutions and political institutions. The First Amendment obviously has the religious liberty clauses in it. The phrase separation of church and state has become kind of a bad phrase in some
right.
people's mind. Where did that come from?
Well,
what's the development?
What's so interesting, Welton, about the point I make in So Help Me God, to tracing the story of the first American culture war. It's interesting that the religious left of the time, the people who wanted to have absolute separation of church and state, very, very severe, the leaders of that movement were the Baptists. It was the Baptists, the Methodists who were more passive. All of the religious outsiders, the Catholics, the Jews, all wanted church-state separation. Why? Because they knew from past experience that whenever God had a seat in government, it wasn't going to be their God. The religious right back then were the Unitarians, the Congregationalists, the Episcopalians. Why? Because they were the elites. They peopled the governments of the states that had established religions, and it was their churches that benefited from the church-state collusion. So that actually continues, that idea of religious outsiders being supportive of church-state separation or independent spheres, if you'd prefer to put it that way, the religious insiders not being as sensitive to the dangers of this kind of collaboration. And it took throughout the entire first 30 years of our history finally to sort this out. It wasn't until after the War of 1812 that church and state were actually separate, and they remained quite separate from that point on until the Civil War.
Now, I know that some of our listeners are still in the process of adjusting their radios because you said that the Baptists were,
the hard left,
and the Unitarians were the right.
That's exactly right.
Now, how did that flip-flop?
Well, it flip-flopped because today the Baptists are, to a degree, along with the religious right, I would call them, as long as the Republicans are in power anyway, they are the religious insiders. They know that government will have their ear. And so they're not as sensitive to the issue as they were when they were being persecuted, when they had to pay taxes for someone else's churches. But if the Baptists go back to their history, they will find it. And in So Help Me God, the heroes of the book are really the Baptist pastors. I mean, they join with Jefferson and Madison, first of all, to disestablish religion in the state religion of Virginia, and then to create a freedom of conscience clause in the Constitution, the First Amendment. It is, by the way, Welton, it's the Baptist pastors of Orange and Culpeper County, Virginia, who forced Madison to do what he didn't want to do, and that is to champion a Bill of Rights and to write a First Amendment, because he was running for Congress in Virginia, and they'd always been allies throughout their many struggles, but Madison was not in favor of amendments. He did not think there should be a Bill of Rights, and it was the Baptist pressure lobbies in Virginia that forced him to commit, should he be elected to Congress, that he would put at the top of his agenda a Bill of Rights and a First Amendment, a Freedom of Conscience Clause. And so they get credit, the Baptists get credit more than any other group for the establishment of the First Amendment, which today sometimes they complain about.
Recently, I saw numbers 60%+ of the American people that responded said they considered this a Christian nation. Can you believe that?
It's important. Everyone seems fascinated by the history of our founding, and I think that's wonderful. But it's important that we go back to that history and read it straight. And I think that's important for people on the right as well as those on the left. For instance, people need to recognize who are very opposed to any kind of religion in politics that it was the God Party, if you were, the established church party that forced the issue of abolition. If the church-state separatists, the Jeffersonians, the sacred libertarians had had their way, the government would never have gotten involved in emancipation because there was no legislating of morality. But to go back to our founding and say that we were founded as a Christian nation is to actually completely subvert the genius of the founders, who do not introduce religion into the Constitution. And every time, Welton, that there's been an attempt to put God or Christ into the Constitution, that attempt has been very easily knocked down. Are we a religious country? And in fact, do we even have a religious government? To a degree, yes, particularly since the Civil War, when In God We Trust went on the coinage and the idea of a national Thanksgiving was established. But the religiosity of the nation goes back always. The reference is the Declaration of Independence. So part of our being a religious nation is that we defend the rights of church-state separation and religious freedom. That is part of our American religiosity. So to say that we're not at all religious is wrong, and to say that we're Christian is wrong. In fact, we're religious in a kind of Jeffersonian Declaration of Independence way.
Are we going to just keep on talking about the Republican Party as the party of God, the religious party, and the Democratic Party otherwise?
It's changing. When I started writing this book, when I started writing So Help Me God, I thought that we were in danger of creating a religious party and a secular party in this country. It would be an unum party and a pluribus party, if you think about e pluribus unum, one nation under God versus liberty for all. In my opinion, whichever one of those parties won, the nation would lose. What I see happening today is that what always happens, once the pendulum flows too far in the unum direction or in the pluribus direction, there's a natural kind of corrective. The two leading candidates for the Democratic Party, and perhaps even the three, are strong people of faith, very, very comfortable in speaking of their faith, very connected to the church, very much a part of the great American religious mainstream. Some of the leading candidates, at least right now in the polls, the leading candidate for the Republican Party doesn't go to church and has some real problems with his church authorities. Latest polls I've seen, you've probably seen others, but show that the evangelicals are splitting much more evenly among Democrats and Republicans. So I think that danger point of our having a unum party and a pluribus party, a religious party and a secular party, is passing. And it's a good thing because both of our parties need to be aware on the one hand of the importance of a moral foundation for American governance, and on the other hand in the importance of the Liberty Clause and absolute freedom of conscience and freedom of belief.
Forrest, this stuff is in your blood. Anybody that knows you knows that's true. I mean, your dad was a respected governor and United States senator. Your mom was involved in politics. Do you ever personally have trouble reconciling religion and politics in your life?
No, I don't really. You see, I believe that there should be an absolute separation of church and state and that you should not separate religion and politics. Our religious views are our deepest views. They should inform everything else we do. But we need to remember that in this nation, we have a formula that comes out of our Declaration of Independence and Constitution that gives us guidance as to how we can bring our religion to politics. We can bring it as a moral impetus to drive our beliefs and express our beliefs. We cannot use it, however, in any sort of coercive way to bring other people into our fold. And that's why church-state separation needs to be so clearly and distinctly maintained.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Forrest, and what a thrill it is to talk with you with our audience on State of Belief. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for spending your 4th of July weekend with me. In honor of Independence Day, we've been taking a look back at some of our favorite interviews that illustrate the independence we enjoy as Americans, particularly when it comes to our First Amendment. I was fortunate to speak with former New York Times columnist and two-time Pulitzer Prize winner Anthony Lewis. Here's a look back at our conversation about Anthony's recent book, Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, A Biography of the First Amendment. Anthony, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you so much.
I want to read a quote from the book. You write, "Many of the great advances in the quality, the decency of American society were initiated by judges. The truth is that bold judicial decisions have made the country what it is." End of your quote. Do you feel then that the judges are the true protectors of the First Amendment in modern society?
At their best, they are. We have to look to them in the end. The First Amendment words are not self-enforcing. And in fact, the words are "Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press," a very general statement, you know, sweeping. But what does it actually mean in practice? Well, it was added to the Constitution in 1791 and first enforced by the Supreme Court, first time it ever decided in favor of free speech or freedom of the press, was 1931, 140 years later. So we have to depend on judges. For a long time, they looked the other way.
With so much riding on judges, do you worry about all of the politics involved in judicial appointments these days?
Of course I do. It's a very important subject and one to which I may say political candidates, liberal political candidates, Democratic candidates have not paid sufficient attention. Conservatives have been very open about their determination to reshape the Supreme Court into a conservative institution. They said they would, and they did.
You talk about a lot of different cases in your book. Does one of these cases stand out over the others as a defining moment for the protection of the First Amendment?
Yes. The great moments have been in dissent. And I might just read one passage.
Sure.
Because during the years when the court as a whole was not prepared to enforce free expression, there were judges who wanted to, and they began writing dissents in 1919, great dissent by Justice Holmes, in a case in which a group of radicals had thrown a pamphlet from the roof of a building in New York, which criticized President Wilson for sending troops to Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution, political criticism of a kind we would regard as absolutely central to First Amendment freedoms. Mm-hmm. They were prosecuted under the Sedition Act put in by President Wilson, convicted and sentenced to 20 years in prison for those pathetic pamphlets. Hmm. Now, Justice Holmes dissenting said, "Persecution for the expression of opinion seems to me perfectly logical. If you have no doubt of your premises or your power and want a certain result with all your heart, you naturally express your wishes in law and sweep away all opposition. But when men have realized that time has upset many fighting faith, they may come to believe even more than they believe the very foundations of their own conduct that the ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade in ideas. That, at any rate, is the theory of our Constitution. It is an experiment, as all life is an experiment. While that experiment is part of our system, I think that we should be eternally vigilant against attempts to check the expression of opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death. Extraordinary opinion, isn't it?
It is indeed. Is there a time, Mr. Lewis, when speech should not be protected?
Particular time? I don't think so. If you mean to say in our history again and again in times of war or stress, there have been waves of repression. And do I think the right to speak out should have been protected then? Indeed, I do. I think in World War I, when under the Federal Sedition Act and state copies of it, thousands of people were put in prison for the most anodyne comments, criticism. I think that was terrible.
In the recent debate over hate crimes legislation, we were hearing a good bit from people arguing that if you institute hate crimes legislation, you will deny the freedom of speech to people who are opposed to certain lifestyles that are mentioned in that legislation. How do you respond to that?
I think there's a great difference between speech, which should be free, and that, shall we say, killing, which is motivated by hateful ideas. Those two things seem to be very different.
But if someone is saying that lifestyle is absolutely evil and we need to rid the world of that kind of evil.
Well, you're putting your finger on a point that's always in contest in free speech discussions. How close to actual physical violence do you have to get before you can stop people making provocative, inciting remarks? The Supreme Court has said that you can't punish speakers who urge violence unless they are trying to incite people to imminent violence and they're likely to succeed. The imminent violence is likely to occur. That's a very narrow test, a very strict test, and it's very hard to prosecute people under that test. And I think that's okay for speech. When it comes to somebody who, shall we say, has murdered a homosexual because of that, motivated by hatred, I don't take the same view. I think it's okay to include the hatefulness of it in the definition of the crime.
I know some people feel the media have abdicated some of their responsibility in being guardians of free speech. What's your take on that?
I think it's an important point. We depend on the press to keep the government accountable. You know, the average citizen like me can't know whether the government is violating the law or torturing people or things it's done, you know, in recent years. We depend on the press to dig into it and find out. Well, after 9/11, the press seemed to be traumatized, and we went into the Iraq war without any serious press investigation of the grounds for that war. And indeed, after the war had been on for a year or so, the New York Times and the Washington Post actually published apologies for their indolence earlier on. So it's a heavy responsibility, and the press has gotten much better in recent years. It seems to have recovered its courage, and I'm all for that.
I have seen statistics, as I'm sure you have, in recent days, polling data showing people's lack of understanding in some ways of the meaning of the First Amendment and certainly questioning seriously whether the First Amendment guarantees too much freedom. Some have even said that if the First Amendment were put up to a vote today, it probably wouldn't pass. What's your take on that?
I'm not quite that discouraged, although the kind of poll you describe is fairly depressing. On the whole, I think Americans, if asked a blank question, are you in favor of freedom of expression, will say yes. But if they're asked, do you think that imams should be allowed to preach Islamic values and hatred of the West, they'll say no, because they don't really accept in their hearts the idea that's encompassed in the title of my book, Freedom for the Thought That We Hate. Justice Holmes said, freedom of thought, it does not mean freedom for those who agree with us. It means freedom for the thought that we hate. And that's true. If we can single out people whose views are, you know, not acceptable to us and say they must be silenced, then we'll be next.
At the end of writing the project, were you hopeful or were you discouraged about the future of the First Amendment?
Well, it's a good question. I think hopeful on the whole, because we came from a time when there was no protection early in the 20s, as late as 1930. That is to say, the amendment was there, but the courts didn't enforce it. We've come to a time when there's very large-scale, wide judicial enforcement of the right to express yourself, even on controversial subjects. And I don't see any sharp challenge to that right now in law. On the other hand, I have to say, to take a grim possibility, if there were another terrorist attack in this country of a kind like the Twin Towers, I think the fear would be profoundly deeper, and we might be willing to stand for repression. That's happened in our history.
Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, A Biography of the First Amendment, is the new book by Anthony Lewis. Anthony, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief.
It's been my great pleasure. Thank you.
We hope you found meaning in these important conversations as broadcast on Independence Day weekend in 2008. Before we wrap up this week's Independence Day retrospective show, perhaps it's no coincidence that some of the most impactful Supreme Court decisions in recent times have been handed down right before the 4th of July holiday. Notably, the justices struck down the Defense of Marriage Act in 2013. The Hobby Lobby ruling came around the same time in 2014. They granted same-gender couples the right to marry 1 year ago, right before this holiday, in 2015. Of course, each decision sparked spirited celebration as well as withering criticism. But increasingly, differences of opinion among Americans also seem to ignite hostility and even hatred for those with whom we disagree. And so, we'd like to take a couple of minutes to let you hear once again the thoughts Welton Gaddy shared with everyone on Independence Day weekend in 2013 regarding the importance of preserving our tradition of heartfelt disagreements while refusing to give in to the forces that benefit from further and further dividing us.
Before we go today, I want to respond to an email that I received recently from a gentleman who happens to share my name, but apparently does not share my beliefs. After the Supreme Court ruled DOMA unconstitutional and declined to uphold California's Proposition 8, I was quoted in the media as I affirmed this important step forward for our nation. This particular email read in part, "Today was a sad day for the nation, and I am troubled to hear that you were less than defensive in traditional marriage. I've read your statement today, and it troubles my heart. These are the times that test our Christian faith and our sacred beliefs. I'm ashamed of you and all the other heretical, quote, men of faith that took a pass and failed to defend the bedrock foundations of our faith." Now, friends, I realize there are millions of Americans who are feeling let down this week. Some are feeling lost, and many are angry. I realize that there are faith traditions that emphasize imposing one's own understanding of God on others at all costs. And within such a tradition, it must be genuinely difficult to understand how any religious leader can work for the separation of church and state. But as we prepare to celebrate our nation's birthday this coming Thursday, I only can restate what I've said so many times before on this program. Ensuring that no religious group can impose its beliefs on any other group is a cornerstone of what supports our freedoms. That kind of accommodation in a diverse, pluralistic society is guaranteed to cause discomfort and even pain at different times to various members of that society. But think of the alternative. It is domination by one group over all others. And that was neither the vision of the Founding Fathers nor a model that has even once been successfully implemented anywhere in the world since then. The email writer says that I, quoting him, took a pass and failed to defend the bedrock foundations of our faith. Well, I guess he may be right. I didn't and don't support codifying his particular faith in our civil society, but that's not our faith. And just as much, I don't support codifying my faith. It's true that I affirm marriage equality because of my faith, not despite my faith. I've performed same-gender weddings and find profound spiritual value in conveying that dignity on loving, committed couples. But just as I would never stand for being denied the right to perform these ceremonies, I never would stand for another religious leader being required to do such ceremonies. I understand the civil power of the government to levy taxes, but I never would stand for the government compelling citizens to tithe to a particular church. Look, as we prepare to celebrate our nation's birthday, let's try to find ways to respect and even celebrate our diversity. And that includes Americans who are genuinely disturbed by the events of this past week. Because, you know, in the final analysis, there is still so much more that unites us than what divides us. Tune out the incessant voices of divisiveness. Tune in to the hundreds of millions who are living every day with none of the rights, privileges, and yes, blessings that we take for granted in this country. And then go to that barbecue where the conservative family down the street's bound to start a political argument, or where the lesbian couple will bring their daughters and make you uncomfortable. It's going to be a noisy summer. And thank God for that. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. We'll use it wisely. We'll keep State of Belief on the air, and we'll expand the reach of this program at a time when so very few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll also find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show. Stay in touch with us, please, through the week on Facebook and Twitter. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line 800-856-0277. We encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen. We want them to be a part of the conversation. And please join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. Was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.